Today on The World, trying to understand the fighting in Israel and Gaza.
We have religious, ideological extremists on both sides. So part of the conflict has to do with religious convictions.
Also today on the show, we're entering hurricane season. Last year, there were so many storms that scientists ran out of names and had to turn to the Greek alphabet.
Some of the names were similar sounding, with like theta, eta, and zeta occurring consecutively.
With another busy storm season, they're ditching Greek letters and coming up with a new plan. And in China, professional grave robbing has become a booming business.
They get investors to stump up the money for tools, you know, anything from metal detectors all the way to an excavator.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us this Friday. Today, the fighting between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas that controls the Gaza Strip entered its fifth day. The Israeli military initiated a large-scale attack overnight, causing major blackouts inside Gaza. One goal, to destroy a tunnel network under Gaza City used by Hamas. Residents on both sides say it was the most intense fighting in more than a decade. In Gaza, thousands of Palestinians left their homes seeking safety from the Israeli bombs. We begin our coverage today with The World's Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv. What is the scene, Ariel, as we close this week of back-and-forth rocket fire between Gaza and Israel?
Well, the scene right now is that exchanges of fire are still going on both sides of the border. You have Israeli Air Force continuing to drop bombs on Hamas targets. And as we speak, you also have rockets firing into Israel's southern towns, mainly Ashdod and Ashkelon.
So as I said, residents on both sides in Gaza and Israel said this is the most intense fighting they've seen in more than a decade. What was last night like?
People in Gaza described the scene last night as a volcano erupting in the Gaza Strip. There were dozens of bombs dropped in a short period of time. And this was actually one of Israel's military's largest operations in Gaza in years. What happened is that at midnight, the IDF sent out a strange message. It said air and ground troops are currently attacking in Gaza. And this caused a lot of confusion in many international news outlets. And they reported that a ground invasion had actually begun. But in fact, this was a deliberate misdirection by Israel. It was intended to convince Hamas that Israeli troops were sent into Gaza so its militants would enter that network of underground tunnels that they call the Metro. And from there, they would attempt to hurt Israeli infantry soldiers. Once Israel identified that many top militants were in the tunnels, it launched this attack. And there's still so much rubble there that they haven't identified exactly how many casualties.
So how is the Israeli public seeing this, Ariel? How widespread is support for the IDF operation?
Well, Marco, there's currently a lot of public support. I mean, this whole round escalated very, very quickly. And if you look at any other conflict we've had in the past between Israel and Hamas, the big guns, the shooting at Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, those were always saved to the end. This was the last thing that Hamas would pull out. But this time, after Jerusalem, they went straight to Tel Aviv. And that meant that they basically, in terms of the public's eyes, forced Israel's hand and the military to respond. I spoke to Professor Reuven Chazan, who teaches political science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and he explained the public sentiment.
Because let's remember, when we are talking about a conflict with Hamas, this is an organization that, on the one hand, does not recognize Israel's right to exist, period. And on the other, is shooting hundreds, if by now not thousands, of rockets purposefully targeted at Israel's civilian population. You put those two together and you know what Israeli public opinion will come up with.
So, Ariel, we should point out that while this rocket fire is going on, many other towns in Israel, mostly mixed between Jews and Arabs, are seeing violent clashes in the streets. How are things on that front?
Things have slightly calmed down in the past 24 hours, and we're now heading into Shabbat, so we're not expecting to see any mass gatherings of Jews in any town. But Saturday is expected to be the next flashpoint to look out for. Despite many injuries on both Jews and Arabs in many of these towns, so far no one has been killed in these civilian clashes, but perhaps the first casualty to this internal violence is the prospect of a new government. We which would oust Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister.
So kind of a political casualty. Explain that.
Well, I mean, if we were to talk on Monday before the rockets on Jerusalem, I'd tell you that Israel was just days away from forming such a government. I mean, this coalition would have seen for the first time in Israeli history Jewish right-wing and Arab politicians cooperating under one government. But these clashes are making it very difficult politically for these groups to cooperate. I also asked Professor Reuben Chazan about this from the Hebrew University, and this is what he had to say.
And because of the shifted focus from domestic, economic, and social issues to the foreign policy and security issues, the negotiations to put together a government first went on hold. Second, one of the parties already pulled out. In other words, we might not be able to form a government and have to hopefully not move towards another election after an undecisive one just a few months ago.
So as Professor Hassan is saying, a fifth election is looming, and it's pretty much the last thing Israel needs right now.
The World's Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv, thank you for this update.
Thanks, Marco.
It wasn't supposed to be this way. Less than a year ago, we heard that then-President Trump was hailing a new dawn of peace in the Middle East. His administration helped facilitate the normalization of ties between Israel and some of the Arab Gulf states. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
On September 15th of last year, Donald Trump appeared to be pretty proud of himself. He was presiding over the signing of the so-called Abraham Accords between Israel, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. And the White House was laying it on thick. Trump, with the two Arab foreign ministers and the Israeli prime minister, descended the staircase in front of the White House. The four of them walked shoulder to shoulder, in perfect sync, up to a stage on the South Lawn. The scene was set up to look like the one where Israel and Egypt signed the Camp David Accords in 1978.
We're here this afternoon to change the course of history. After decades of division and conflict, we mark the dawn of a new Middle East.
Benjamin Netanyahu was singing the same tune.
This peace will eventually expand to include other Arab states, and ultimately, it can end the Arab-Israeli conflict once and for all.
Fast forward 8 months, and the Holy Land is caught in yet another deadly spiral of violence between the Israeli military and Palestinian militant groups in the Gaza Strip. It's the most intense fighting in years and could even turn into a full-blown war. So much for the promises of the Abraham Accords. Khalid El-Gindi is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
That line that these accords would bring peace was always packaging, it was spin, it was marketing.
At the very least, he says, it was wishful thinking. And that's because the Abraham Accords were never really about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In fact, it didn't address those issues in a serious way at all.
They're based on trade interests, strategic interests vis-a-vis Iran, weapons trade. I mean, the notion that they would lead to or even facilitate peace between Israelis and Palestinians was always fanciful.
But what about these new diplomatic relationships? The fact is, Israel now has ties with several of its Arab neighbors, as well as Morocco and Sudan. Could these countries be in a position to help facilitate peace between Israel and the Palestinians? Hussein Ibish of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington says, probably not.
They lack relations with Hamas. They lack sway in the West Bank. They just don't have that role.
And it's more than that, says Michelle Dunn of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. She says these Muslim-majority nations normalizing relations with the Jewish state lack the political will to make a real difference.
I think there was never an intention on the part of any of the countries that normalize their relations with Israel to use those agreements on behalf of the Palestinians.
And to her point, Hussein Ibish says there is a popular hashtag on Twitter in the UAE these days.
Hashtag Palestine is not my cause is trending, in Arabic, of course. It's trending.
If people believed the message from Trump and Netanyahu that the Abraham Accords would somehow bring about the end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they were probably fooling themselves, says Michelle Dunn. That's because of a basic misconception.
There's this idea that if Israel makes peace with the Arabs in the form of Arab states, then the Palestinians are so weak and so few that making peace with them is not important. But this just simply isn't true. And the whole idea put forward by the Trump administration that Israel could make peace with Arab states and that the Palestinians could be pressured to accept something far less than a real state, that this has just turned out to be false.
Khalid El-Gindi at Brookings says what's going on right now in the region has exposed the utter failure of Trump's plan.
No, you can't just wish the Palestinians away. You can't pretend the occupation doesn't exist. You can't pretend that the day-to-day pressures and inequalities on Palestinians aren't there.
Because that's when things can erupt into violence, as they have so many times over the years. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Coming up on the show, The View from Gaza.
As you are speaking to me right now, I hear bombings around the area where I live in Gaza City. It's been very tough, very intense. The fighting is just going from bad to worse.
A political scientist in Gaza City talks about today and the past century, historical reasons for the anger and mistrust between Jews and Arabs living side by side in the Middle East.
If you want to look at the conflict right now, yes, I think we made a mistake. The Palestinians and the Arabs made a very strategic mistake by not accepting the partition plan at that time.
That's coming up in a few minutes. By now, you've heard the news from the CDC. If you're fully vaccinated, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says you can ditch your mask and stop social distancing in most cases, even indoors. It's a big moment here in the U.S. Meanwhile, in other parts of the world, people are celebrating the end of other pandemic restrictions. The World's Lydia Manalidou tells us about a big milestone in Greece today.
For the first time in more than 6 months today, I was able to leave my house without having to text the Greek government and get permission. If you listen to the show, you have probably heard me talk or maybe even complain about this. I'm going to play a clip of me explaining this texting requirement to Marco back in November.
How does that work? Like just on your cell phone, I guess.
Yeah, so there are six reasons you're allowed to go out for, and they each have a number. So, for example, say I want to go exercise, that's number six. So what I'll do is I'll start a text to this government number. I put the number six, first, last name, and my address. And then right away, I get a response that I can go out. So everyone here in Greece had to do this. Every time I left my house, whether it was to go get some souvlaki or go on a walk, I had to text this number, and there was police everywhere. They were stopping people to check that they had gotten permission. And today was the first time in more than 6 months that I didn't have to do that. And it was actually kind of emotional. Like, I walked to the local bakery in the morning to get some bread, and I didn't expect that it would make me tear up not having to text the government to get permission. So now I'm going to have my first evening outing in a long time without having to send a text. In fact, I might actually even leave my phone back, which I haven't been able to do in a while because I was afraid I would get stopped and checked. And with that, I am out. No text, no problem. I hope everybody has a great weekend. Oh, and for the world, I'm Lydia Manolidou in Athens, Greece.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Another hurricane season is just around the corner. The last one was intense, with 30 named storms in the Atlantic region. A storm gets an official name when its top winds exceed 39 miles per hour. This season is expected to be even more active. As the World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports, it's all happening as emergency management systems are already stretched to their limits.
Caribbean island nations were spared the worst of last year's hurricanes. Michelle Forbes is the head of emergency management for St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
We really were quite pleased that we did not have any cyclones that would have put persons in emergency shelters, because we know that opens up the conduit for the spreading of the COVID-19 virus.
But in a year of overlapping disasters, that changed for St. Vincent last month when the La Soufrière volcano erupted. Forbes says nearly 20,000 people were displaced. Emergency shelters are still full. And thick volcanic ash deposits mean even average rains can trigger dangerous landslides and flooding. Forbes Emergency Management Office posted videos on Facebook of surging mudslides to warn residents to be careful.
You know, that's a different twist now to the hurricane season. It's not just the regular flooding. So these are the things now that we are working on communicating to the public.
She's called the pandemic, volcano, and now the upcoming hurricane season a triple whammy. And it's meant lots of late nights at the office.
I have slept at my home for 5 nights since April 8th. 5 nights. And I made that decision that this week I am going to return and sleep at my home every night, you know, just for my sanity.
The Atlantic hurricane season officially starts June 1st, but named storms have been arriving before that in recent years.
I pulled up a list of them, actually, in recent
years. Kevin Trenberth is a distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research.
Alex in 2016, Arlene in 2017. Alberto.
Trenberth says improvements in satellite technology make it easier to spot these early storms. But there's also some evidence that hurricane season is getting longer.
There is certainly the suspicion that the hurricane season is not only starting earlier, but ending later. This is consistent with the idea that, you know, climate change is occurring, and so the oceans are warming and the environment evidently is changing sufficiently to enable these tropical storms to occur.
Regional officials are thinking about moving the official start date for the Atlantic hurricane season to May 15th for future years. And this year, the National Hurricane Center is starting to issue its routine tropical storm forecasts on that date. Daniel Brown is a senior hurricane specialist there who says the past 6 years have all seen named storms form before June 1st.
And so because of that, we're going to go ahead and start providing information on May 15th, routine information about disturbances that might form into tropical storms or hurricanes before or right around the start of hurricane season.
Another change this season, no more storms named after Greek letters. They were used last year for just the second time ever after the 21-name alphabetical list was exhausted. But officials decided that having 9 storms named after Greek letters was just too confusing.
Some of the names were similar sounding with like theta, eta, and zeta occurring consecutively. Some of the names didn't translate well into other languages that are used in the region, Spanish and French. So it was decided by the committee to no longer use that as a supplemental name list.
Instead, there's a second alphabetical list of names as a backup. Brown says he worries that 14 months into a pandemic, so-called disaster fatigue, might leave residents of hurricane-prone regions less likely to prepare for this season. And at the official level, capacity and budgets for emergency response are already under strain.
It's been quite an intense period, both regionally and nationally for the Caribbean. And of course, we wait to see what the 2021 season will bring.
Elizabeth Riley is the acting head of the Caribbean Disaster Emergency Management Agency. She says emergency operation centers are typically set up for a few weeks when a storm hits. But those same centers have been activated for more than a year straight dealing with the pandemic.
There is, at the national level, very clearly a level of fatigue.
Riley's team mobilized first responders from across the region to help with the volcanic eruption in St. Vincent. When they did, they had to avoid sending people from COVID-19 hotspots who would have had to quarantine for 3 weeks before getting to work.
It has made the situation that much more complex, and it means that we have to take into account looking at the risk related to multiple hazards as we're undertaking the planning in the region.
Planning for a season that's once again expected to be supercharged. In the Pacific, this year's storm season got its earliest start ever on Monday with Tropical Storm Andres. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Here's something you don't hear about every day. Robbing old graves, some of them quite ancient, and plundering the relics. A taboo industry that has gone mainstream in China. Some think it's grown in popularity because of the hit serialized novel Grave Robbers Chronicles by Chinese writer Xu Lei. It's also been turned into a popular TV show.
carefully!
That's entertainment, but in real life, digging up the dead has become big business in China. It's discussed in a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Stephanie Studer is a China correspondent for The Economist and has reported on grave robbers there.
Now what we're seeing is that more of them are professional. They run grave robbing rings and they fan out across China. They get investors to stump up the money for tools, which can be, you know, anything from metal detectors all the way to an excavator. And investors also cover their travel expenses. I spoke to an independent scholar, Ni Fang Liu, who has looked at grave robbing through the ages for many years now. And he told me that on a recent visit to northeastern China, he was approached by a thief who was trying to raise such funds. In fact, he turned out to be the brother of a senior policeman, which also shows the ways in which these robbers are increasingly well connected too. And that makes it very hard for the authorities to crack down on it.
It's gotten so out of control that Chinese authorities are now pushing back.
China is in the midst of a year-long crackdown on grave robbing. It recently published figures that showed that it arrested 2,400 tomb raiders last year and was able to retrieve over 31,000 stolen items. And that was three times as many as in 2019. And on top of that, it's making punishments more severe. A couple of years ago, the leader of a ring of 200 grave robbers was put to death, and they're extending prison times. One was sentenced last year to 15 years in jail. So now with these publicly televised digs, authorities are hoping to show the value of archaeology and ensure that those items are properly cared for and exhibited to the public.
That's Stephanie Studer of The Economist speaking about the growth of illegal tomb raiders in China. Stephanie was a recent guest on The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. To hear more of her conversation, look for Economist Radio wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to The World. Indoor dining will be returning to England on Monday. Diners can't wait. Reservation bookings are already full. Some major snags, however. Who's going to cook? Who's going to take your order?
It's very tough to find British people doing waiters and bartenders or mopping floors.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Returning to the situation in Israel and Gaza, last night Israel launched an intense series of airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. It was a response to rocket attacks launched by Hamas militants targeting Israel. I spoke with political scientist Mekaymer Abousada earlier today. He and his family live in and around Gaza City.
I have a family member, my mother and family members, who live in the area where the bombing was very intense last night. There were bombings for about 4 or 5 hours from midnight until the early hours. 11 people were killed. Tens of Palestinians were injured. And as you are speaking to me right now, I hear bombings around the area where I live in Gaza City. It's been very tough, very intense. The fighting is just going from bad to worse.
And how is your mother after those events last night near her home?
It was a very scary night. I have to admit that they did not sleep all night long.
So, Mekaymer, we wanted to speak with you because you're a historian. You can provide some of the background to where the intensity of this fight originates. You teach political science. What do you want your students to know historically to help them understand what's happening today?
The Palestinian-Israeli conflict was created on May 15 of 1948 when Israel declared its independence on historic Palestine, and the Palestinians and Arabs rejected Israeli independence at that time. The first war of Arab-Israeli war erupted. And as a result of that war in 1948, Israel dominated 78% of historic Palestine and left the other 22%, which is now called Gaza, West Bank, and East Jerusalem, under Arab control.
What about the Israeli perspective? Like, the Israelis were small in numbers, and five much larger Arab nations attacked them in 1948. Israel won the war. Is that taught? How is that taught?
if you want to look at it, that part of the problem is that we have religious, ideological extremists on both sides, on the Israeli side, the Palestinian side, who each one basically is saying that this land is very sacred, this land is a land that was given to the Jews. Muslims and Palestinians say that Al-Aqsa Mosque is a sacred place, the second most sacred place in Islam. So part of the conflict between the Jews and the Palestinian Arabs has to do with religious beliefs and religious convictions.
So when 1948 came around, the UN partition plan was accepted by Israel and rejected by the Palestinians, which led to this war of five nations attacking Israel, which Israel won. Can Palestinians still claim victimization because of that?
Well, yes, it's true that there was a UN General Assembly resolution number 181, which decided to partition Palestine into two states, one Jewish and one Arab. Yes, the Palestinians and the Arabs rejected the partition plan. The Jews accepted the partition plan. If you want to look at the conflict right now, yes, I think we made a mistake. The Palestinians and the Arabs made a very strategic mistake by not accepting the partition plan at that time.
So I know this is a question that probably has a very long answer, but from your perspective, Mekaymer, what is the way out of this conflict? And can history help us find a path out of this current round of violence?
The way out is the implementation of international law. If Israel at any point accept the implementation of international law and UN Security Council resolutions, that would be the beginning to pave the road toward a peaceful settlement to the prolonged Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Mekaymer Abusada is a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza City. Mekaymer, stay safe. The best to your mother, and thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure to be with you. Thanks very much for calling.
Since the start of the Syrian civil war, the government there has carried out more than 300 chemical attacks inside the country. The immediate results have been devastating, death and lifelong injuries. Now some families and doctors are asking whether the chemical attacks could have led to serious health problems in pregnant women and their babies. The world's Shirin Jafari has been looking into that.
Dalia Khaled Al-Masood remembers the day her neighborhood came under chemical attack. It was the early hours of morning, April 4th, 2017. We were sitting outside, she says, and suddenly there was a smell. I felt my heart sink. I couldn't breathe. We went inside, Dalia goes on to say, and closed the door. But the smell continued to follow us. What can I tell you, Dalia asks. Just thinking about that day is difficult. The chemical attack happened in Khan Sheikhoun in northwestern Syria, a fact-finding mission set up by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons found that sarin or sarin-like substance was used. The United Nations found the Syrian government responsible for that attack. The immediate impact on the community was devastating. Local health officials reported at least 89 people were killed and about 500 people injured. Dalia's family survived that day, but she says the exposure to sarin and possibly some other chemicals had a lasting impact on her and especially on her baby. Dalia was a month into her pregnancy, she says. Her husband later said she fainted and was foaming at the mouth during the attack. She had two children already, both healthy, so Dalia knew what a normal pregnancy is like. But this one, she says, felt different. She says the baby's pulse was weak and she wasn't moving much. Doctors confirmed her worst suspicion when they did an ultrasound. The baby's limbs had not fully developed. When Fatima was born, her head was swollen like a balloon, Dalia says. And sure enough, she had no hands or feet. I cried. For 15 days, the baby's eyelids were closed and there was a yellow liquid coming out of her eyes, Dalia tells me. She says, it feels like a test from God. Then she breaks down. Fatima is now 4 years old. The swelling of her head has subsided and her eyes are open, but she still requires constant attention. Dalia and her husband say there are no other disabilities or deformities in their families, except for Dalia's sister, who also became pregnant around the time of the chemical attack. Her baby died shortly after birth.
I think there's more cases similar to this.
Hisham Al-Saleh is the manager of the National Syrian Project for Prosthetic Limbs, an NGO in Turkey that was started by a group of Syrian doctors.
Now we have three similar cases. Three at the same time, same age, that means there's more.
Babies from the same area in Syria, whose mothers were pregnant at the time of the chemical attacks and who were born with similar deformities.
Some of them, we don't know, maybe that in the camps in Syria, we have the same situation.
Saleh says it's likely that there are more cases in displacement camps for Syrians. Many babies don't survive, he says, because of the severity of their deformities. Others we might not know about simply because they can't reach centers like his because of the ongoing war.
The uses of chemical weapons in general is prohibited, internationally prohibited. So we are not able to link or to find any scientific data that explain what's going on.
Dr. Sawsan Jabri used to teach pulmonary diseases at Damascus University. She says it's difficult to conduct research in Syria. In part, that's because the Syrian government doesn't allow any research that could shed light on its atrocities. Yet in 2014, Jabri herself heard from a Syrian doctor working in an area that came under chemical attack the previous year.
He saw a lot of miscarriages and stillbirths and birth defects among those who are exposed to the chemical attack.
The two doctors teamed up to conduct a small observational study. They found that among 110 pregnant women who had exposure to the chemical attack, 49% experienced miscarriages or stillbirth or delivered babies with some kind of deformity.
Yes, we have immediate effect, which is the massive, you know, death, the massacre that happened at that day. But still there were some kind of like long-term consequences of the chemical attack.
Other doctors told me similar stories.
Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Dr. Mohannad Al-Khatib was a dentist in Syria, but when the war began, he volunteered to help out at a field hospital in Ghouta, outside of Damascus. Khatib told me how he personally helped deliver at least 13 babies with severe deformities, all in the span of 1 year after a chemical attack. He says typically doctors would discover problems when they did ultrasounds. In most cases, he says, the babies didn't survive. Khatib shared three photos with me that he took himself. They showed newborns with severe birth defects. One had an arm growing out of its neck. Zayed Ali Duaymas is the father of Fatma, the four-year-old I meet at the clinic in Turkey. He has no doubt that the chemical attack they went through had an impact on his daughter's health. I'm sure not 100%, but 1,000%, he tells me. We've never seen anything like this. Sawsan Jabri, who conducted the research, says these testimonies should be a wake-up call for the international community.
I hope there will be more study on the link between the chemical exposure and pregnancy outcome or consequences. There must be more extensive study on that issue.
She says sarin remains in the environment for a long time, so there's a lot to learn about what it might be doing to the health of people exposed to it in Syria. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Reyhan Lee, Turkey.
Tibetans have a new leader today, Tibetans in exile, that is. Tibet proper is part of China, but about 150,000 Tibetans live outside of their ancestral homeland. And for decades, they looked to the administration based in Dharamsala, India, as their representative government. The diaspora community has elected Bempa Tsering as the next president, or Sikyong, of the Central Tibetan Administration. Reporter Ashley Westerman spoke with Tibet's new leader in exile, along with voters living abroad, and sent us this report.
Every time the Tibetan diaspora goes to the polls, it's an international effort. But this year, it happened during a pandemic. 41-year-old Dechen Pemba voted outdoors in London.
It was in a sort of public park, but it was all socially distanced, and there was hand sanitizer and hand wipes everywhere, and people were, you know, wearing masks.
Pemba's parents fled Tibet in the 1950s and 60s after Chinese annexation. She's a spokeswoman for Smart Vote Tibet, a multilingual online guide that put election and candidate information all in one place for the first time since the Parliament in Exile was created in 2011. The Tibetan diaspora includes some 130,000 people around the world.
To carry out an election in exile or diaspora for an exile government is just logistically very difficult. So it's quite an amazing feat for it all to happen.
The Central Tibetan Administration is headquartered in Dharamshala, India, and operates an annual budget of some $45 million. It represents the exiled diaspora and serves as a voice for the 3.5 million Tibetans still inside Tibet. Experts say it also plays a critical role keeping Tibetans like Pemba connected to the homeland.
Even though physically I'm far away from Tibet, I feel quite close to Tibet.
But maintaining this close cultural connection is becoming more difficult, says Kate Saunders, an independent researcher and writer specializing in Tibet. She says in addition to fewer Tibetans leaving, China has moved into a new phase of assimilation of the Tibetan people.
And what that means is that the Chinese Communist Party has developed new measures to break the connections between generations and to obliterate memories and knowledge of Tibet in the past.
Human rights groups say China has severely restricted free speech, religious freedom, movement, and assembly in Tibet, while increasing surveillance and tightening border controls. The stakes are high for the incoming Central Tibetan Administration, says Saunders.
In terms of protecting and preserving the cultural, the religious, the national identity of Tibetans.
The Central Tibetan Administration and the Dalai Lama, Tibet's exiled spiritual leader, have adopted the middle way approach, which allows Tibet to remain part of China, but with some autonomy. The biggest challenge for the incoming president will be how to deal with China, says Sering Shakya, a Tibetan scholar at the University of British Columbia.
Actually, there's very limited things he can do. But other aspect is actually there is a global tension.
Shakya says Tibet's exiled leaders should seize on China's rising tensions with other countries over issues such as the pandemic, border disputes, and the Uyghurs, and use it to their advantage to help advance the diaspora's priorities, because
long term, I mean, there is a very little chance of China initiating any kind of dialogue with the diaspora movement or the Central Tibetan Administration.
President-elect Pemba Tsering says deepening relationships with governments around the world is a top priority for his administration.
Those countries and people who cherish values of freedom, democracy, so we'll reach out to as many as possible and win their support for the cause of Tibet.
Meanwhile, the aging Dalai Lama will decide in the coming years whether or not he will reincarnate. He suggested he may not. But if he does, the process to find the next Dalai Lama remains uncertain, and China has already announced they plan to appoint their own. Still, the election that just took place is meaningful, experts say, particularly since the Tibetan diaspora has come to claim democracy as an important characteristic of their people. In London, Dechen Pemba wouldn't say who she voted for, but is glad the election went smoothly.
You know, having this sort of active, vibrant democracy, I think, is something that everybody wants and, you know, we can be proud of.
For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
The world keeps on spinning. This week, reporter Shirin Jafari has taken us to the border of Syria and Turkey, where Syrians displaced by a decade of war struggle to rebuild their lives. Check out more of Shirin's coverage on our website, theworld.org. Again, that's theworld.org. You know what I'm really looking forward to? A good meal at a restaurant, eating inside. On Monday, people in England will be able to dine indoors for the first time in nearly 6 months. Demand for tables is sky high. Great news for restaurant owners. But there's a problem. They can't get enough staff. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has our story.
James Chiaverini has been serving Londoners Italian food for decades.
The restaurant was founded in 1967 by my father, Pino Chiaverini, who emigrated to the UK from the Apennine Mountains in northern Italy.
Chiaverini says his restaurant, Il Portico, is one of the oldest family-run restaurants in London. Today, because of COVID restrictions, customers can only sit outside and the rain is bucketing down. Restaurant manager Antonio Larrea is trying to rearrange tables under a canopy. Starting Monday, though, indoor dining will be allowed, and Larrea tells me that's giving him a different headache.
In my time here as a manager, I never struggle as much as I'm struggling now to get stuff. Before, you will see every day they bring you three or four CVs, you will see people asking for jobs. Since the Brexit and now with the pandemic, it's been very tough for managers to get stuff.
Many workers have left the hospitality industry over the past year because lockdown forced a lot of businesses to close. And now, for the first time, British restaurants are also starting to feel the effects of Brexit. The industry relies heavily on foreign workers, many from the EU. But under new Brexit rules, European Union citizens now need a visa to work in Britain. And Chiaverini says London might no longer seem so appealing.
Now that they need a visa to come, they're not going to do that to London. But say, for example, you're from Bulgaria. You can go to Berlin, you can go to Madrid, you can go to Portugal, you can go and work anywhere. Now it's the summer, especially all around the Mediterranean. They're desperate for people to come and work on the summer season. So they're going to go there.
I ask his restaurant manager, Antonio Larrea, if they could hire British people to do the work.
No way. It's very tough to find British people doing waiters and bartenders or baristas or people cleaning toilets or mopping floors.
While we're talking, a young woman has been serving coffee. She tells me her name is Giada Calabrese. She's from southern Italy and she says she knows of Italians who've decided not to come back to the UK to work. It's just too expensive, she says.
I think because for visa is a lot of money. So you need to pay rent, live in London, that is not easy. And visa is an extra, so I don't think it's easy for Italian people come here and start to do something.
But some EU citizens are coming back to Britain now that the pandemic restrictions are being lifted. And some have faced a far from welcoming response when they arrive. Marta Lomartire, a young Italian woman, flew to London a couple of weeks ago. She was due to start a job as an au pair, but when she landed at Heathrow Airport, she was approached by the UK Border Police. Her cousin Giuseppe Picchiere explained what happened next to the BBC.
They thought that she was going to be taken to a place that she couldn't quite understand what this place was going to be. But from Google Translate, she thought that this was going to be a prison. And she was telling me that there is barbed wire everywhere. And when she arrived there in the middle of the night and she was put into a room and there was nobody else there, and she asked not to lock the door because I think she was pretty scared.
His cousin was taken to an immigrant detention centre and later deported back to Italy. The UK government says those detained are breaking the rules, but some advocates say those rules are unclear. Luke Piper is with the 3 Million, a group that represents EU citizens in the UK. He also says border police are being unduly harsh.
What appears to be the case is quite a disproportionate behaviour from the UK authorities. The cases that we've seen and some of the people we've spoken to, it does appear that the UK authorities have been quite heavy-handed in these instances.
Piper says the actions of the immigration authorities could well turn European citizens off coming to Britain to work altogether.
It wouldn't surprise me if people would be a little bit deterred by these stories. It doesn't send a positive message, and I think it's damaging.
COVID restrictions also mean it's more difficult for all people arriving into the UK right now. Kate Nichols is chief executive with the industry trade group UK Hospitality. She says one solution for UK restaurants could be if the government introduced a special COVID-19 recovery visa.
It's a temporary work visa for helping with COVID recovery where the economy is still in a state of turmoil and the job market is still very unsettled. So it allows people to fill exactly the kind of labour shortages that we're facing as we try and get the economy moving again and as we unwind furlough.
But that doesn't solve the problems restaurants like Il Portico are facing next Monday. I ask manager Antonio Larrea if the lack of staff means he'll have to turn customers away.
Never, no. We'll never cut tables because we're short of staff. We better work harder rather than to do something else.
Which means they may be working harder for some time to come. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Yesterday, in the city of Glasgow in Scotland, British immigration officials launched a raid in one of the city's most diverse neighborhoods. Two men believed to be immigrants from India were removed from their homes and held in a white van marked Immigration Enforcement and Home Office. That did not sit right with their neighbors, who decided they were not having it. "These are our neighbors, let them go." That was a cry of hundreds of protesters who gathered around the van, preventing it from leaving, as you heard in that clip from local news site Glasgow Live. Some demonstrators sat in the road. One man even crawled underneath the van and stayed there. 7 hours went by. Eventually, authorities released the two men, who emerged from the van to the cheers of the crowd. Police later confirmed that the men had been released. The neighborhood that was raided is home to one of the largest Muslim communities in Scotland. The incident raised alarms among Scotland's leadership. First Minister Nicola Sturgeon condemned the raid as unacceptable, especially as it came on the holiday of Eid al-Fitr. Scotland's Justice Secretary Humza Yousaf echoed the First Minister.
"To take this action at any time is unwelcome in Scotland. To do so in the heart of the Muslim community on the day of Eid, where there have been outbreaks of COVID, is reckless and dangerous health, and frankly looks like it was intended to provoke."
Intended to provoke. Yousaf went on to say,
"The hostile environment created by the UK government's immigration policies is something that is simply not welcome here in Scotland."
And that is going to do it for us today. Carol Hills will be in the host chair for a couple of weeks while I'm on vacation. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We're back with you on Monday.